You're listening to The Leonard Lopez Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
New York Magazine was a publishing sensation from the very first issue. 3 weeks later, a nude photo by Dan Arbus appeared in its pages and advertisers fled, causing it to face near bankruptcy. From the zenith of success to near oblivion in just four issues. No wonder New Yorkers embraced the magazine, which is now celebrating its 40th anniversary. The roster of its contributors over the years is a stunning list of talent, ranging from Tom Wolfe to Kurt Anderson, from Gail Shee and Jay McInerney to Pete Hamill and Gloria Steinem. Random House has just released a collection of landmark writing from the magazine called New York Stories, and I'm very pleased that it brings Gail Shee and Adam Moss, the magazine's current editor, to this show. And later we'll be joined by one of the magazine's favorite contributors, Pete Hamill. Such a pleasure to see you.
Oh, thanks for having
so
us.
So nice to be here, Leonard.
Now, when we talk about New York Magazine, aren't we talking about the vision, really, of one man, at least at the start, Clay Felker, your recently deceased husband?
Oh, also mentor, editor, lifelong companion. And I started writing for Clay at the New York Herald Tribune. I was a prisoner in the Flamingo Pink Women's Department, as they called it at that time.
And they had a very famous women's page.
Yes, they did, with Eugenia Shepherd as the head. So we did get to do some wonderful writing there. Jim Bellows was the editor of the overall newspaper, and I was writing things about women, on Harlem rent strike and women on drugs in the women's house of detention and how terribly they were treated. And it was all very gritty stuff. And one day Bellows called me into the office and I thought I was going to be fired. And he said, I like this kind of gritty stuff in the middle of the cooking and fashion page. Keep doing it. So I was very fortunate. So I had the temerity to crawl down the back stairs one day to the city room floor and to Clay's office to suggest a story, because I knew Eugenia would be very angry. And I heard him shouting, which many people have heard, and shouting this famous remark, which Tom Wolfe says that he had done research in Webster Groves, where Clay grew up, and that this was what his sister told Tom was the first words out of Clay's mouth as an infant. What do you mean you don't have my reservation?
Well, he was a quintessential New Yorker, but he came from the Midwest.
He came from the Midwest, from a Webster Groves, right smack in the middle of the country, border state. He was he had a granddad who lived in Joplin, Missouri, but he was reading The New Yorker when he was 10 years old, and his dad was a newspaper man. Both his grandparents, grandmom and grandpop, had graduated from the University of Missouri Journalism School, as his mom and dad did.
So he was enlisted to create this magazine for the Herald Tribune, the Sunday magazine. In those days, except for the New York Times magazine, those Sunday inserts were pretty awful, weren't they?
They were the bottom feeders, absolutely. They were just at total advertising vehicles. And here this was, a completely fresh cultural compendium. And Underground Gourmet and other of the great features of New York Magazine were born in that supplement. And one of my favorite pieces, and one of the most scandalous pieces of all, which was the profile of William Shawn and
Tiny Mummies.
Tiny Mummies, the true story of the rules of 4030 Street, Land of the Walking Dead, I mean, which created a firestorm that isn't really all the embers aren't out today.
Well, it threw down the gauntlet. It said, we are challenging The New Yorker as a magazine, or in this case, a Sunday supplement that is about New York City.
Right.
Done with that in mind to cause a sensation?
Yes. Oh, totally. Clay and Tom Wolfe cooked that up. I mean, that was their caper. And because they thought The New Yorker at that time, under William Shawn, who was really a recluse of the order, first of magnitude, had become very suburban. And these guys were totally New York and reinventing New York as a new generation does every generation. So they pulled this off and caused a great firestorm. And Clay thought this should be, New York should be the New Yorker with pictures, as in Life and Sports Illustrated, which were two magazines he'd worked for.
Actually, The New Yorker later made that adjustment under Tina Brown,
under Tina Brown.
And brought in pictures.
Right.
But so there was this firestorm, and many people lined up on the side of the New Yorker. How dare you go after William Shulman?
Oh, absolutely.
And others said, well, this is great.
That's right. Well, I tell you, Clay told me he knew what a real city editor was the day that he walked into Jim Bellow's office. Oh, because here's what happened. William Shawn called up Clay when he heard this profile was running, like 2 days before, and said, "This cannot run. This cannot stand." And he said, Clay said, "Well, Mr. Shawn, I have to tell you, you know, the plates are already made." And he said, "I'll buy the plates."
Wow.
"I'll buy the plates." So Clay walks into Jim Bellows' office and says, "You know what? I just had this phone call." And the next thing you know, Bellows is on two phones calling Time and Newsweek. And Clay said, "That's a city editor."
So that really.
And Clay was bluffing, right? I mean, it wasn't on the plates yet.
I don't think so.
That's what I'd ever
Yeah,
heard.
No, it wasn't on the plates yet.
So, of course, this was great publicity. Right. But what would have happened if two things hadn't occurred? The Trib folded. And Clay Felker hadn't lost a power struggle at Esquire magazine.
Oh, I think he would have. He always wanted to do his own publication. He made his own little first newspaper when he was 8 years old in Webster Groves on a hexagraph in the cellar. So that was always his dream. He would have done it one way or another.
He was, but the Trib did fold.
Yeah.
And then how long after that?
It took about a year to raise the money, which, you know, is sort of unthinkable today. It's so difficult to have him do a startup. But he had a lot of enthusiastic investors who loved New York City and wanted to see something like this.
Well, he'd also been at Esquire. And to some degree, New York Magazine is as much a child of Esquire as it is of anything.
Right. The same.
He had lost a power struggle there? How did that work?
Yes. Well, he and
Harold Hayes
were both battling under Arnold Gingrich, who was a magnificent editor, and he presided over what they call the blood on the wall era, where all of the young Turks were told to, you know, spill out their story ideas, and then each would shout each other down, and the winner would walk out, you know, looking like a rose. So he lost to Harold Hayes, and Byron Dobell, I think, had preceded him there. So Clay went off to the Herald Tribune, which at that time was, it's one of those great utopian newspapers that people all mourn for years afterwards.
Yeah. Well, it was much better written than any newspaper in New York.
Absolutely. And, you know, Breslin was there, Tom Wolfe was there, Hamill was there, Gay Talese was there. I mean, it was amazing.
So the whole staff of the early staff of New York Magazine was there. But Clay had already set certain tones. For example, didn't he coin the phrase or the word Siberia for a bad seat in a restaurant?
Yes.
That was at Esquire. So certain things, and then Gail Green picked that up later in New York Magazine.
Right. Well, you know, Gail Green, like so many of Clay's progeny, was not on track to be a food critic. She was doing other kinds of stories, but she wrote a story in which the story was boring, so she interviewed the chef, and that made the story. So Clay said, "Okay, you're going to be the restaurant critic." And she was, "Oh, really?" Joan Hamburg, one of your colleagues who has been on the radio for years and years and years, she was in advertising. And he said, "You're going to be a radio star." So he gave people the confidence to do things they hadn't even thought of. But he knew where their talent lay.
My guests are Gail Sheehy and Adam Moss. Adam Moss, the current editor of New York Magazine. We're talking about the history of New York Magazine now, presented in a collection of some of the best stories from the past, from four decades of the magazine's history. Celebrated its 40th anniversary in April, was it?
Technically, yeah. April 8th was the day of the first issue in 68.
And the list of contributors, Jimmy Breslin, Gloria Steinem, Nora Ephron, Pete Hamill, Stephen Sondheim.
He did the crossword puzzle.
Really?
That was Stephen Sondheim's contribution, and we have in the book his first, where he's introducing the kind, he brings over a British-style crossword puzzle to America, and he has to explain it to his sophisticated New York audience. And it's a wonderful little essay, and we have the crossword puzzle and the answers.
And so many of these people, I'm not going through the whole list, maybe some of them will come up in our conversation, but these are some of the most famous reporters, journalists, mm-hmm. whatever, essayists of our time.
They are. You know, tonight is a memorial for Clay and Byron Dobell, who was an editor with Clay, friends for years, is going to read a roll call. But I said, well, how many writers are you going to talk about? He said, I can't even talk about the writers. He said, I'm only going to read the roll call of those who went on to become editors of their own publications or of other major publications and art directors.
Some of the writers found their voices while working on the magazine. How did Gloria Steinem's article, After Black Power, Women's Liberation, change her direction?
Well, what was very interesting, I reread it. Gloria was just about 2 minutes later into feminism than some of the early, you know, high-profile, flaming feminists. And when she wrote this piece about black liberation, she married her own liberal and even radical ideas about changing the class divisions in this country to feminism, and saw that women needed to be liberated, not just poor people.
But she describes being told after the article was published not to get involved with these crazy women.
That's right. you know, Gloria was very glamorous with her aviator glasses and her long fingernails and had been a bunny.
Although that was a feminist act, if you read the
article.
That
was a feminist act, yes, afterwards. So the first article on feminism in New York was written by Julie Baumgold, who was, I think she wouldn't mind my saying, a Jewish princess. So it wasn't exactly her natural tribe either, but she wrote a hilarious piece.
Yeah, it was great. It almost made it into the collection, mm-hmm. As so many.
Now, Clay helped Gloria Steinem start Ms. Magazine. So right. He was also somebody who didn't just want to keep his writers. He wanted them to fly on their own.
Oh, it was not only that. You see, Leonard, I think Clay's secret was he knew how to interview people. He would really talk to people for 2 or 3 hours about their lives and their point of view, and then he would find what was unique about their voice and liberate it in them. And then they would be off on their own. When Gloria talked to him about women and where women stood in the world and how they needed to be liberated, he immediately recognized this as true and real, and she was the carrier of the message.
Adam, weren't you 11 years old when the magazine
I was
launched?
But I read, you know, If my memory serves me right, I read this magazine from the first moment. I think my parents were charter subscribers. It was
really?
It was the first magazine that ever got me excited about magazines. And it, you know, like I think for so many people, probably many were more were older than I was. But it gave me my idea of what New York was. I mean, it had such a perfectly coherent and sustained idea of New York City. You know, to this day, I'm not sure whether that was an idea that was kind of just in Clay's mind or whether he was actually reflecting back the city that he saw. Cause and effect is very hard to figure out here.
Well, one of his talents, according to Tom Wolfe, was in detecting new styles of life. And mm-hmm. we've always associated New York Magazine with that. And some of the famous phrases that have come out of New York Magazine have had to do with that, identifying something that's happening now.
Well, he really broke down, from what one can tell, and I participate in this only as a kind of, it would be ridiculous to call myself a scholar of it, but I've now read so many issues of the old magazine, he really changed what was appropriate for journalism. I mean, mm-hmm. journalism used to be a very kind of sort of stiff enterprise in a way. And his interest was trying to find a way to talk about journalistically the sorts of things people talk about over dinner. Mm-hmm. And that was radical mm-hmm. at the time.
Well, one of the big differences between New York and The New Yorker is that writers are allowed to use the word I.
Yes. However, that was a mistake in hanging that on the New Journalism, because Clay really didn't believe in the reporter being the head of the story. Sometimes the reporter, was in that role, but mostly in Tom's story, Tom Wolfe's stories, he's not.
Yeah, but I can't imagine Jimmy Breslin ever writing anything that doesn't have I in it.
No, Jimmy was definitely an I writer, but.
But what was more conspicuous, really, was a kind of uninhibited and freewheeling prose that mm-hmm. wasn't about the writer as character so much as it was Clay's, I think, one of the his great gifts as an editor was to let writers write in the voice they had.
Their
I mean, as
voice.
Gail just described, he would find the voice and help them find the voice for them. But then he would just let them go. Mm-hmm. And yet, with all of these different competing voices in the magazine still had a singular voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that was its great accomplishment.
Well, that was Clay's, I think, Clay's, you know, perspective on the world. And funnily enough, when he read The New Yorker as a boy, just like you, Adam, reading it when you were a boy, I'm talking about Esquire now. His vision of Esquire and the editors of Esquire was they came to work in black tie so that they could leave at 5 and go on to a series of cocktail parties. But that was Arnold Gingrich creating the, you know, Esquire, the New York, that he had in his mind. But if I could, Leonard, I'd just love to read. There's just a couple of sentences in here in Tom Wolfe's The Me Decade that I think reflect what Adam is saying.
Talking about coining phrases, the Me
coining
Decade.
Phrases, yes. And we know The Me Decade. But this was one of my favorite ones, and I laughed again when I read it this many years later. He's talking about the holy role and how Jerry Brown and Jimmy Carter had both come up from state politics aglow with mystical religious streaks. And he said Carter turned out to be an evangelical. He was of the missionary, lectern-pounding, amen, ten-finger C major chord, Sister Martha at the Yamaha keyboard, lob-lolly, Piney Woods, Baptist faith.
Now breathe.
Now, if somebody wrote that in an article for you, Adam, would you just say great?
Well, if it was Tom Wolfe's voice, yes. But one of the problems with someone like Tom Wolfe is that he inspired a lot of people who weren't as talented as he was, and so that there was a kind of lot of sort of fake, kind of I guess Gonzo, but Gonzo was more identified with Hunter Thompson. But it was really the same thing, sort of a fake energy. And you have to be able to tell the good ones from the bad ones. And, you know, and looking back in the old issues of New York Magazine, what is so remarkable is that there is so little bad exuberance in it that Clay was able to tell the good from the bad.
My guests are Adam Moss, who is the current editor of New York Magazine, Gail Sheehy, who was there from the start, and we're going to take a little break, come back. We'll talk more about this book called New York Stories, Landmark Writing from 4 Decades of New York Magazine, published by Random House. And we'll also bring Pete Hamill into the conversation. Pete there from the beginning as well. We're back to our little celebration of 40 years of New York Magazine, talking about a new collection published by Random House in paperback called New York Stories, and it has an incredible array of writers with articles, many of them quite memorable. With me is Adam Moss, who is the current editor of New York Magazine, Gail Sheehy, who was there from the start, and Pete Hamill has just joined us. Pete, the article we have in this collection was from 1969 about the white lower middle class, an article that I think should be mandatory reading for this year's political candidates.
At least in Brooklyn.
was your first article for the magazine?
No, I had done a few before that. I can't remember which was first or second, but it was right after the Viva photograph ran. So when I showed up at the office, it was like walking into Frankie Campbell's or something.
Now, the Viva photograph is the photograph that got everybody in so much trouble. It's hard to imagine something like that happening today. But we're talking about the late 60s when everybody was peace and love. So how the heck, why did it cause so much trouble then?
Well, I guess advertisers were very, very prudish and sensitive to it. I was thinking about it the other day. What happened was that they published a naked picture of Viva, a great Dan Arbus picture of Viva.
Viva the Andy Warhol
creation. And the magazine was almost sunk. And then I was thinking of the 40-year distance. When we published in February, a naked picture of Lindsay Lohan, it practically made the magazine.
Yeah. It tells you how much things have changed. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Well, it could have been worse. It could have been a naked picture of Robert Wagner.
Oh, you talk about the mayor or the actor?
Now,
it's amazing when you look at that article. You made the claim that mostly the white working class fights every American war. At that time, African Americans were generally rejected because of some of the tests that recruits were given.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It was a different city, but not unfamiliar if you look around now. The redlining and everything that went on at the time is all over, and with the end of redlining, we ended up with a mortgage crisis. There's all kinds of changes that affect us now from what it was then, but I think the anger of the white working class, because jobs were fleeing New York, never to come back, manufacturing jobs, waterfront jobs, all those, led to Ronald Reagan and all kinds of other things later on when people voted against their best interests.
Well, it's interesting to note the range of writers for New York Magazine. You have Tom Wolfe, who I don't know if he was as far to the right in those days as he has become, but him, then people like you, Gloria Steinem,
Gail Sheehy.
Thank you.
I guess the magazine was welcoming to people of all different political stripes. It could publish Radical Chic, which
right.
many people took as a serious critique, an attack on the left. At the same time, publish all of these writers who obviously had leftist leanings, well,
yeah,
liberal leanings.
But I think Clay as an editor, was the least ideological person in an ideological time. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the reasons for the success.
And Gail is nodding her head yes.
Yes. Well, Clay said to me one time, I was very infused with anti-war sentiment. I was always going off to marches, and Clay would just sort of shake his head. And I said, but Clay, you know, there's going to be a revolution. And he said, I come from the Midwest. There is no revolution.
There wasn't even a revelation.
But I think that also applied, Leonard, to style, that there was not one way to write for the magazine. Mm-hmm. It was not true of The New Yorker either, you know, for all the bland writing that Sean endorsed. He also had Joe Liebling and people like that writing for the,
and
for
Joe
the
Mitchell.
New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe Mitchell, before he stopped smoking and gave up writing for life.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was that was so wonderful about Clay as an editor. He was one of the best editors I ever had because he was open to things.
Mm-hmm.
He would. My most vivid memory of him was on 32nd Street. They didn't have offices. They had partitions. And I was sitting on the other side finishing something under deadline. And I could hear Clay in the morning meeting with Milton Glaser. And he comes in, and Gail, you must know this well. He would go out to two cocktail parties and come back with five ideas.
Exactly.
Two of which were good. And Milton would say, but Clay, what's the headline on this piece? How do I illustrate it? And that would bring Clay down to reality, and I realized that Clay edited the magazine, and Milton edited Clay.
Absolutely.
Now, we should point out Milton Glaser is the great illustrator. He's been a guest on the show many times, and he's the guy who gave us that famous New York logo that still looks fresh 40 years later.
That's
yes.
Right.
And the look
yes.
of the magazine has pretty much been consistent over the years.
Yeah.
Well, I would disagree with that. I think Adam has revived the Felker touch. And Clay was extremely happy when Adam took over and he saw the magazine morph into something fresh and new in its own style, but very much in the tradition of what Clay had tried to do.
Well, that's very nice.
My guess. I have to do a break. I have to do a break.
Oh, okay.
The FCC insists on these things. We're talking about New York Magazine with Adam Moss, Gail Sheehy, and Pete Hamill. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Okay, what were you saying, Pete?
The other thing that Clay was a genius at is that he covered New York and looked at it as if he were a foreign correspondent.
Right.
He wanted to know what most people never asked who lived here. Why is it here? Who owns the joint? And so his sense of trying to understand power and the way it works in New York is something that stamped the magazine almost from the beginning and is one of the reasons, if you were writing a modern history of New York, you have to consult those magazines.
You know, it's absolutely true. And Milton put his finger on this. Milton, having grown up in the Bronx, born in the back of a grocery store, and when he encountered Clay, he thought Clay was just from nowhere and was inventing a life in New York, which he did. And they became the odd couple. And later, Milton realized that we need people like this, those of us who grow up in New York, to look at it with their nose pressed up against the glass, as Clay always did, and find it absolutely astonishing.
Right.
Look at what they're doing on Wall Street. I mean, if Clay were alive today, he would just be over the top with what's going on for what kind of stories it would afford.
Well, what shouts out from the magazine's earliest years was that the magazine was sort of simultaneously besotted with New York and with the power dynamic of New York, and yet also deeply skeptical and critical of it, which is a very mean trick to pull off.
It's interesting how many films have come out of New York magazine stories, including Grey Gardens. I don't know whether the Maisels read your article.
Oh, you know, the ladies of Grey Gardens like to perform for men, and so I'd actually been negotiating with them to do a film, but as soon as the Maisels guys came along, they just said, over the top, yes, film, please.
And then we have the Saturday Night Fever, being inspired by an article that looks like probably was a bit made up.
Well, it was a bit made up, and that was something that Nick Cohn, who went out to do the story, saw something happen, but didn't see the particulars that he would later write about. And he was a wonderful fiction writer, and he wrote this wonderful piece of fiction, and then years later came clean in the pages of New York Magazine.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have the kind of fact checking that the New Yorker is famous for.
Oh, we do now.
Absolutely.
One of the interesting sidelights of that is Tom Wolfe's complaints about Saturday Night Fever, that it popularized white suits and undermined the uniqueness of his look for a while. Then people discovered how difficult they are to keep clean, and so he wound up again pretty much with the monopoly.
I have a little story about Tom that I think you find amusing. Really, about 10 days before Clay died, Tom came over, as he often did in Clay's later years, to tell him stories, make him laugh. And he told him about how he had been there'd just been an article about Tom and his economic genius in the New York Times the week before. And Clay wanted to know, where did this come from? So Tom said, well, I was a guest on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange a year ago, and all of a sudden I saw this beehive of people around one trading desk, wandered over, and it was something called the Blackstone Group. Tom's never heard of it. Next thing you know, a television reporter sticks a microphone under his nose and says, Mr. Wolf, what can you say about the Blackstone IPO? And Tom said, it's the end of capitalism as we know it. And the New York Times, a year later, just this last June, wrote this very serious piece about how Tom Wolfe was way ahead. He'd seen everything that was happening. And Tom said, you know, well, if I did, I'm the idiot savant.
One of the favorite genres of the magazine could be called something like The Fall from Grace.
Mm-hmm.
Truman Capote to John Gottfried to Elliot Spitzer. Obviously, New Yorkers love these stories. And in a couple of cases, actually, New York Magazine was ahead of The Fall from Grace, like the story on Bess Meyerson.
Mm-hmm.
That's a wonderful story.
Yes,
You know, we were looking as we were going through the archives here for some surprises, some pieces that we didn't know, and we found this great piece by Susan Berman, the late Susan Berman, mm-hmm. On Bess Meyerson, which was this just enormously hostile encounter between the two of them. It really is a genre I don't actually usually like in a story, which is how I got the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's about her pursuing Bess Meyerson and her and Bess Meyerson essentially succumbing and then trying to control every step of the way, the story.
Well, is that unreasonable for a celebrity?
No. I mean, you know, the writer, in a sense, has all the power, and so the subject tries to use what power he or she has as much as possible. But the dynamic was so naked on the page that it was just this very exciting piece of journalism.
Mm-hmm. Now, Pete, did you get involved in the Norman Mailer, Jimmy Breslin campaign?
No, I didn't. I went to one of the founding meetings and I said, this is not the best thing in the world to do. because I thought it would elect the guy you don't want to elect. And Jimmy later said, I went in thinking I was going to run with someone like Auden, and I found out I was running with someone like Ezra Pound.
But he must have been pleased that he received more votes than Mailer
yes,
did.
That was his great triumph.
So, you know, usually you end these things with, well, what's the future of this magazine? It is hard to sustain freshness over 40 years, and you've done things to change the magazine in that regard. But do you still try to keep the Clay Felker mission?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the when I walked in there, you know, my main mission was to restore the magazine to the principles that Clay had founded it with, and then to spin it forward. And obviously, magazines have to be modern; they have to be contemporary, but they have to be built on certain core values. And those core values had to some extent been blurred by the various people who had owned the magazine in the subsequent years.
And sure has gone through a lot of different owners.
It has, yes.
In a couple of cases, owners who you would have thought would have meddled with it more recognized that it was stupid to screw around with something that was a success. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, you know, that was a famous line that Tom says in the foreword of the New York Stories, and he tells about the new owners when the Australian Killer Bee took over at the end of the first year. So their board of directors was looking around and sort of saying, you know, what happened to the golden goose? What happened to the golden goose? And Tom's answer is, well, you know, you killed the goose.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've all seen that happen. People buy something because it's a success, and then they ruin it. Mm-hmm. But right now you have pretty much total independence?
We are very blessed with a boy. I didn't realize you'd give me an opportunity to kiss up to my boss. But we have a.
Okay. I kiss up to my boss all the time.
We have wonderful ownership in Bruce Wasserstein. He's been. He really believes in the magazine that Clay founded, and he's let us. Play with it in that spirit.
Well, I have to ask the both of you, Gail and Pete, what you're up to these days, because I haven't seen books from either of you in a little while.
Ah, well, Pete, let's hear from you.
Pete, I saw you at the Brooklyn Book Festival, and you said you didn't have anything in the works at the moment.
No, I'm halfway through a new novel, but I just have completed a piece for New York Magazine.
Whoa!
Which will be publishing next week.
Yeah. 40 years ago, I did a piece urging people to consider living in Brooklyn because you can get brownstones for $30,000.
It's called Brooklyn, the Sane Alternative.
So you're the guy who caused all of that that land rush that's made Brooklyn so expensive.
Oh, yeah, and there's possible suicides in the coming weeks as mortgages are foreclosed and people have to live realistically, but... and so you keep doing your work. I don't know how to do anything else.
I'm writing a book about caregiving, family caregiving, which is something I did a long time with Clay, and I can see that it's not on the radar screen of our candidates, and it's the big tsunami coming down the pike.
And I want to thank you for being on our show today, Gail Sheehy, Pete Hamill, Adam Moss. We've been talking about New York Magazine, and there's a new book called New York Stories, Landmark Writing from 4 Decades of New York Magazine, featuring some of the most famous people in American journalism and published by Random House. New York Magazine is hosting a memorial tribute to founding editor Clay Felker tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. at the New York Society for Ethical Culture at 2 West 64th Street at Central Park West, and everyone is welcome to go. They're also planning a full year of events in celebration of the 40th anniversary. We have a link to that schedule posted on our show page at WNYC.org.